Shattering Mists is devoted to those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are the problem, not the solution. Our mission is to look behind the headlines, to know who is perpetrating the crimes that, over the course of the next 15 years, will wreak havoc on our planet. And as a result, in our second hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, because its covenant provides the only reliable escape. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it's toll-free. It's 877-300-7645. A frequent listener to the program emailed me just a moment ago to tell me that there's a featured editorial position on the GCN homepage. We broadcast on the Genesis Communication Network. It reads, "It's the law. The American view of government is the biblical view." The paragraph that follows was written by Michael Anthony Perucca. It reads, "At the foundation of every social order is a concept of law and government. For most of history of our country, this foundation was the Bible, the Word of God, including both the Old and New Testaments. Thus, the American view of law and government is founded on the biblical view of law and government. This is explicitly made clear in the Declaration of Independence, which makes reference to the laws of nature and of nature's God, and the supreme judge of the world." Wow. It's amazing how conspiracy and Christianity have become bedfellows here at GCN. There is no divinely inspired book called a Bible. Bible is the name of a pagan sun goddess. It's the name of the goddess Biblia. She is a Egyptian goddess. The Word of God does not include an Old Testament or a New Testament. There is no New Testament. And as it relates to the one called Old, it is simply the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms. Most of the Christian New Testament was scribed by Paul, who was overtly opposed to the God who authored the Torah, and thus cannot be the Word of God, because it is universally in opposition to God. Moreover, the Torah is not comprised of laws. Torah means teaching. It means guidance. There is a Torah presentation of economic governance, and there's a Torah presentation of moral governance. The economic governance is presented in the Yobel. Every 50 years, debts are to be forgiven, land is to be redistributed, and all slaves and indentured servants are to be freed. It's a way of allowing all the benefits of free enterprise without the problem of certain families becoming insanely wealthy by passing on the gains of one generation to the next generation who did not themselves earn them. There is no correlation whatsoever between the U.S. Constitution and Yahweh's Torah teaching, just as there is no law in the Torah, only guidance regarding our interactions with one another, our relationship with God, and, of course, in the presentation of Yobel in the book called Kara, which means to invite and to call out, corrupted to Leviticus, this understanding of God's view of economics. We don't do any of those things in America. There is absolutely no correlation. And to speak of a reference to the laws of nature in caps, Thomas Jefferson was showing his allegiance to the Jacobins, of which he was a member. Now, I happen to be a fan of Thomas Jefferson. I think he's one of the brightest minds in the history of the world. But the fact of the matter is that the laws of nature and nature's God is a reference to what we consider today to be socialist secular humanism, political correctness. It is a outgrowth of the Jacobins, who were an outgrowth of Adam Weishaupt's Order of the Illums. Now, I don't want to go into conspiracy theory here. I'm just telling you that that's the basis of that concept. It's a concept that was marshaled also in Hitler's Mein Kampf. And so if the laws of nature and nature's God and such terms are biblical, then so is Hitler's Mein Kampf. It is an essential part of most socialist and communist ideals. It is pathetic how misguided people are, and how misguided people want to share their views and present their views as if they are profound truth. We're in a mess today because poorly informed, irrational people are communicating lies in a manner that presents them as being credible in hopes that people believe them. Last week, there was news, just genuine excitement, with the President of the United States taking all credit for a lowering of unemployment claims. Well, this week, we find that the Americans filing new claims for unemployment rose so sharply, it's the largest weekly increase in over a year. And that the numbers from last week were understated. Initial claims for state unemployment benefits surged 68,000 to a seasonally adjusted 368,000. Our government is in the business of misleading. And this whole notion of who is unemployed has become a subject of myth, because you are not considered unemployed if you're not actively looking for a job. And so if somebody just says, you know, I'm not looking for a job anymore, even though they're unemployed, they're not counted as unemployed. The fact is that of those Americans that are of the appropriate age and ability to work, it's only about half of them work, which means that 50% of Americans, just considering those Americans able to work, are actually working. The unemployment rate is actually 50%. Now, if you just consider Americans that don't work because they choose not to work, Americans that are underemployed, and Americans that are officially unemployed, the number is about 25 to 30%. The other thing that, of course, has made news here recently is unemployment benefits. Now imagine a government so warped that it would call unemployment a benefit, that you would have a benefit, a reward, for being unemployed. So why would anybody ever want to look for a job? They're now considering constraining the amount of time to back to the more normal 6 months versus what has been in effect for now lasting over a year on unemployment of benefits. There's a report out today from CNN. It speaks of the growing levels of conflict, of terrorism, and of toppling of regimes in the Middle East and in North Africa. Gee, what is the common denominator of the people living in the Middle East and in North Africa? Perhaps they're about 90% Muslim, as well as political violence in East Africa, which is also overwhelmingly Islamic, are driving a rise in political instability, not only in those areas, but worldwide. According to research by the UK risk analysis firm Maplecroft. Okay, so you needed a research firm to tell you that the Islamic world is in conflict, that it is a source of terrorism, and that regimes throughout the Islamic world are being toppled, and that that collectively is providing political instability around the world. You know, perhaps I should put up a sign on the internet and say, you know, for $1.50, I will provide a survey for you. Don't need the millions of dollars that were spent by Maplecroft to do this sort of stuff. In fact, I think anyone listening to this program would be fully capable of providing such a survey. What do you think, Larry? Does it take a PhD and a few million dollars worth of research to figure out that Muslims are behaving badly?
It ain't rocket science. You know, it's somebody was tied in and got $1 million from the government. I mean, please.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's like building a $640 million hey. Website for, you know, Obamacare. It's
well, that's
just
what it
all
was. That's before. Yeah, that was what it cost before they broke it. Speaking of, before they tried to fix it, speaking of waste, did you know that the federal government has spent four times that amount over the last 10 years on accounting systems for the Department of Defense, and thus far the Department of Defense does not have a single functioning accounting system and has never actually presented an audited financial statement to the American people?
No, I didn't know exactly that, but I could have guessed something like that. You know?
Yeah, it's astonishingly inappropriate what we have done with the Department of Defense. Anyway, this says that since 2010, now you could have picked 2000, you could have picked 1990, you could have picked 1980, you could have went all the way to 1960 if you want to see the rise of Islamic terrorism around the world. It says 1 in 10 countries surveyed have experienced a significant increase in the level of political risk. These risks include governments asserting control over natural resources, oh my, regimes being ousted by popular uprisings, and the exploitation of foreign investors' assets. And you say, OPEC? Yes, it's saying that the risks include the expropriation of foreign investors' assets. You know, Larry, about 5 or 6 years ago, I wrote a book called maybe 7 or 8 years ago now, time flies, a book called The Islamic Terrorism Timeline. I wanted to find out, you know, how we got into this position where Muslims were committing 99.9% of the terrorist acts worldwide. So I did a little survey. I went to the government to say, I want to do a survey here. Can you send me a few billion dollars so that it can be official? No, I didn't do that. I use the old interweb, as they say, and studied terrorist acts. I recorded every significant reported terrorist act worldwide, starting around 1960, and I grew weary of the project through about 2004. And what I found is that there's a direct correlation between the expropriation of foreign investors' assets in the Islamic countries that comprise OPEC and the exportation of Islamic terrorism. Islamic terrorism prior to OPEC was in the range of about 20% of terrorism worldwide, and it was almost universally perpetrated in Islamic countries. And then with OPEC, fundamentalist Islam is fueled. They provide the fuel for Islamic terrorism and the ability to export Islam's signature act worldwide. And as a direct result of OPEC and of governments working against the interest of their people and in the interest of the OPECers, we find that now 99.9% of terrorist acts worldwide are perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims, and that they are fueled principally by the OPEC Islamic countries. Yeah, didn't even need a study to find that out. This goes on to say that the findings form a part of the latest Maplecroft Political Risk Atlas, which uses 52 indicators to help companies monitor political issues affecting the business environment in 197 countries. So it's a big operation there in the UK. Since 2010, Syria has deteriorated the most. I wonder which one of their 52 indicators that they had to use to figure out that Syria is the most unstable place on earth. That, you know, if you're a Christian in Syria, you're as good as dead. If you were a Shia in Syria, you're going to be hunted down and terrorized by Sunnis. And if you're a Sunni, the government is trying to put you out of the jihad business. Well, just in case you were wondering, Syria, which, by the way, is
coming and going, don't they?
Yeah, is the trade the most. It now ranks second compared with a 44th place ranking in 2010. There is a country that ranked as being more unstable than Syria. It happens to be the country that Bill Clinton decided that he would encourage Americans to feed without any military cover.
That's got to rank Somalia.
Yeah, Somalia. Yeah, there you go. Last time I checked.
Central.
Yeah, do you think that Somalia is an Islamic country?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you know what the third worst country is? It's the country that the United States, under King George II, went in to invade to provide democracy in the American way. Third most unstable country on earth.
And we're there.
And we're still there. Afghanistan.
Yeah, how lovely is that?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that really upset me, I was, while we were spreading democracy over there, I read an article where a woman was being given 200 lashes.
Yeah.
And after they gave this woman, they made her stay naked the whole time, by the way.
Of course.
And they'd come in and they'd beat her. Mm-hmm. And it took them a week to give her 200 lashes to where she wouldn't die. But, you know, they got to. And then after they got done, they took her out back and put a bullet in the back of her head.
Oh,
now,
okay. When did this occur?
This is about a year ago.
Okay, so this is Afghanistan under United States influence. Okay.
Yeah, under the spreading of democracy.
Yeah, we sure did fix that country, didn't we?
Yeah, I thought to myself, why in the hell are we there?
You know? Well, to make a bad situation worse? To spill blood? To give legitimacy to the American military? To justify the tyrannical state that we have built here? To support the myth of the war against terrorism? To bankrupt the country? Pick your poison. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering this report by Maplecroft, which is a think tank out of and research institute in the UK. Yesterday I made the statement that a scholar is someone who knows many things and understands nothing. Larry, see if you can apply that to the next two sentences in this report from CNN.
I'll give it my best shot.
Okay. Egypt has been downgraded to extreme risk for the first time as a result of violence following the ousting of former President Mohamed Morsi and an increase in terrorist attacks in the Sinai Peninsula, the report said. Maplecroft warned that Syria, Egypt, and Libya are now so bad that they will be mired in exceptionally high levels of dynamic political risk for years to come, end quote. What are they missing there?
Well, I think they're missing the fact that these are Islamic, fundamental Islamic countries. You know, when you pass a law that it's okay to go have sex with your dead wife for up to 6 hours or something to that effect, you know you're in the wrong place. And Wow.
Yeah.
You know, you might consider coming out of retirement and selling your services here.
Yeah, I think so. You know, here's this report, and it correctly identifies Egypt, Syria, and Libya as being really bad, and that they're going to be mired in exceptionally high levels of, well, political risk for years to come. The risk in those countries isn't political, it's religious. And what's happened in those countries is that they have all either gone from a secular government to a fundamentalist religious government, or they're in the process of doing so, or they have gone from secular to religious back to militaristic and are in a flux between those things. It's the problem here isn't politics. There's one common denominator between these countries.
Yeah, when you mix religion and politics, you have a desperate situation. I mean, yes. and that's bad.
But while the mix of religion and politics is a real problem, the root of the problem here is the religion that sees itself as a political entity. But the core problem in these countries is all Islam. In fact, it goes on to say, the report said there's a higher chance for social unrest to exacerbate political instability in Bangladesh, the stands, particularly Kazakhstan, and Saudi Arabia. Geez, common denominator there too, isn't there? You know, so far
there
is Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Bangladesh. They didn't mention, of course, Pakistan, which is in the midst of a civil war. Syria, Egypt, Libya. Gee, I'm seeing a trend.
You know, in this paranoid culture of political correctness, it's pretty hard for people to stand up and just say, look, Islam is death.
Yeah, it is.
In so many ways.
It's destructive. It's delusional. And it is deadly.
And it's gone on for thousands of years now, or
right.
Since. You know.
It hasn't changed.
No, and no. It's not going to change.
That is correct.
There is no, as bad as the Western oligarchs are, and
yes,
they're bad.
And then they're bad.
And they use these guys, too.
Right. As corrupt and deceitful and deadly and damning as Christianity is.
Yeah.
And it's bad.
Yeah, it's real bad.
But
it's hard to imagine selling slavery for, you know what, last 1,400 years.
Yeah.
The idea that being in religious submission and flat out slavery.
Yeah. Now Maplecroft here.
1,400 years.
Now Maplecroft's not going to mention religion. Their quote here is, quote, "This is due to the erosion of democratic freedoms, increasing the crackdowns on political positions, and the brutality by security forces towards protesters, compounded by working conditions." No,
that
it's due to Islam.
That is obviously stupid.
Yeah,
that is stupid.
Right. Yeah, Islam means submission. So there are no freedoms in an Islamic country. So Islam is the root cause of an erosion of freedoms. Islam is the root cause of crackdowns on political positions because Islam will not tolerate a rival. It tends towards dictatorships. And brutality by security forces towards protesters is anyone who protests against an authority in an Islamic country is killed.
Well, you know what happens there. They're protesting just like the Inquisitions, really.
Yes.
They're protesting. When they protest against the government, who are they protesting against?
The religion. Allah.
Well, they say it's God.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So.
Both sides claim God is on their term, but it's Allah. And also it says compounded by poor working conditions. You know, the fact is, if you look at the most impoverished countries in the world, most of them are Islamic. Another concern for investors, the article read, is that there has been a major increase in opposition by governments, by governments worldwide. Yes, as Islam becomes more salaf, more fundamentalist, people's rights are suppressed. It is the, in fact, any time religion is empowered over people, including the religion and the worst religion of all, which is the religion of man, socialist secular humanism, there's an increase in oppression. And if you want to know what it's like to be oppressed, you know, you should have done what I did and traveled through communist China 30 years ago. You should have traveled through communist Russia and the Eastern Bloc countries 30 years ago and seen with your own eyes what the religion of man, socialist secular humanism, does to oppress people. And then if you want to really have an eyeball full of oppression in today's world, if you can get into North Korea, I guess you could join the tattooed one of basketball fame and go in with him. But if you're not going to go to North Korea, then go to most any Islamic country. And you'll know what oppression is all about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, this erosion of political freedoms, this is a quote, is central to driving the wider risk of unrest and instability in the medium to long term, said Charlotte Ingram, the senior political risk analyst for Maplecroft. So the erosion of political freedoms is the central cause of the deteriorating conditions in those countries which are all Islamic. It's not the rise of fundamentalist Islam. This woman can't see the tree, and her nose is on it. But that's just the astonishing nature of our world today. Most people are just plain old ignorant. They're just too apathetic to even care to know. And those who do know, who are paid to know, can't think. Now, this person is right on top of one of the biggest problems in our world today and can't find the common denominator, can't make the connection.
It's astonishing. It's
probably
ignorant.
Yeah. In 2010, prior to the Arab Spring, now, not going to talk about the rise of fundamentalist Islam. We're going to talk about it as the Arab Spring. It says, in 2010, prior to the Arab Spring, Libya, Tunisia, Iran, Syria, and Egypt. Do you think there's a common denominator among those countries, too, right? And by the way, Arab is not the common denominator because Libya, Tunisia, and Iran are not Arab nations.
That's right.
Okay. So, you know, the Arab Spring doesn't apply. Iran happens to be Persian, and Libya and Tunisia are Northern African, as is Egypt. You know, it's not Arab. Anyway. In 2010, prior to the Arab Spring, Libya, Tunisia, Iran, Syria, and Egypt were among the countries with the biggest divide between political freedoms and social gains. So that is their primary criterion, a divide in their matrix between political freedoms and social gains. Not the rise of fundamentalist Islam, no, between political freedoms and social gains, if there's a divide between the two. Maplecroft predicts that the growing imbalance between social gains and political freedoms in Bahrain, Azerbaijan, and South Africa, which has a hugely increasing Islamic population, will heighten the risk of instability in those countries in 2014 and beyond. Yeah, we've had.
Oh, well, you better believe it, especially in SA. I mean, it's just insane over there, but, you know, that's.
And the problem isn't the rise and the empowerment of fundamentalist Islam, something that Barack Hussein Obama played a significant role in doing. I mean, his speech in Cairo was really the impetus of all of this, where he spoke to Muslims saying it was their time, that the West owes them an apology, that they have the world's great religion, that they've changed the landscape of the world. And that the world was now theirs.
Oh, yeah, all the modern inventions. The car, the speedboat, the air conditioning, the, you know, indoor plumbing. These were all no doubt.
You know, in fact, you can't even attribute the algebra or the...
Outside the wheel, it's over. Okay.
Yeah, well, none of it took place. And as a result of Islam, as you know, East African countries saw the biggest increase in the risk of political violence. This is because of the rise of fundamentalist Islam, not only in the Sudan and in Somalia, but it's their invasion of Kenya and Ethiopia as a result of the rise of Islamic terror in countries that are mostly Islamic.
Here's an interesting thing I'd like to point out. I'm sure you know this. We paid $1 million, apparently, the U.S. taxpayer did, to rewrite the Constitution of Kenya. And that was headed, by the way, by none other than the scumbag Desmond Tutu. Now, part of this new constitution is that it is hate speech to say anything negative about Islam.
There you go. Perfect. It says that
That was the Obama administration. Now, why would you or I go to work to have a constitution rewritten that wouldn't allow anybody to speak the truth about Islam?
Because we're being dictated to. So Somalia, the Sudan, are in the extreme risk category, which are purely Islamic, while Kenya and Ethiopia are in high risk because they're being invaded by Islamic terrorists from the Sudan and Somalia. Eritrea, which is been taken over by fundamentalist Muslims, Tanzania, which is under attack by Muslims, and Mozambique, also saw a change in their risk category. 3 years after the Arab Spring, more than 60% of countries in the Middle East and North Africa have seen a significant rise in political violence, demonstrating the long-term political risks associated with forced regime change, the report says. So the risk is with forced regime change, even if it's by popular election, not by Islam. New shattering this. We are in a horrible situation in Afghanistan. We hinted at it previously. George Bush, based on a series of lies, invaded Afghanistan about 12 years ago. And as a result, we have spilled blood and coin, making a very bad situation much worse. And now it appears that the only reason that the United States can't continue to play in Afghanistan, continue to have tens of thousands of U.S. troops there continuing to aggravate the Islamic world is because Salman Karzai no longer wants to play along. He was quoted as saying, "My trust with America is not good. I do not trust them, and they do not trust me." I'm going to tell you, Karzai is probably the single most corrupt leader worldwide. It's very much like what United States did in Vietnam. Remember, we didn't like the puppet government. We didn't like the government of Vietnam. We started our own puppet government, and then that government became one of the most corrupt in the world. Well, we did the exact same thing in Afghanistan. And our puppet now, who has raped the country blind and stolen tens of billions of dollars from American taxpayers, is saying, you know, the American government doesn't trust me. you know what Salman Karzai's job was prior to him being bequeathed the title of president over that country? He had migrated. He rose to political power being the foreign secretary for the Taliban. And after serving as the foreign secretary for the Taliban, something that was important because that's the reason he was hired by Texas oil companies to negotiate a treaty with the Taliban so that Western oil companies could build a pipeline through Western Afghanistan, thereby bringing the Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves down to a free water port, which would also have them go through Pakistan, which intended to tax them. And so that was his political background and economic background. He was an oil executive because he was a Taliban representative, and we can't figure out why this guy is untrustworthy. Now, mind you, what he's currently doing is in America's interest. He's saying, I'm not going to sign an agreement with America to continue American troops. He knows that if he does so, he's signing his own death certificate. Because the Taliban will have him killed if he signs it. And if he doesn't sign it, the Taliban will probably incorporate him back into their fold. But, you know, it's amazing. We had one of the most evil people on earth, Putin, who's making a whole lot of sense these days, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which way you want to look at it. Putin saved us from engaging in World War III by bombing Syria with its allies being China and Russia. And Now, Haman Karzai is the person standing up so that America can't keep its troops in Afghanistan.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. Now, speaking of Afghanistan, after they brought in all of the Islamic warlords throughout Afghanistan, and they have this meeting that's called the Loya Hirja, a delegation of Afghan high the this is funny. A delegation of the Afghan, I can't even read this without cracking up. A delegation of the Afghan High Peace Council.
The High Peace
Council of Afghanistan will reportedly visit Pakistan to renew a push to end the decades-long conflict. Why would they be going to Pakistan? It says they're going there to visit Baradar. Baradar is a supreme leader of the Taliban. He's the number two leader of the Taliban. Now, the supreme leader of the Taliban is Mullah Muhammad Omar, who is the one-eyed cleric that has gone into hiding. Well, Baradar has not gone into hiding, and he is the top deputy to Mullah Muhammad Omar, and so the High Peace Council is going to visit with him to get holy water, of course, on a peace deal. He was freed, this Baradar, from a jail in Pakistan in September at the request of the Afghan government to help facilitate the peace process. Of course, he has denounced peace process and has denounced U.S. troops remaining in Afghanistan. Now, in the world of Mullah Omar and Mullah Badar and many of the Taliban leaders, their path to peace is driven, according to the CNN report, by the power of religious visions and dreams. And we'll consider those dreams when we return to Shattering This in a moment.